Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck at katelovingschenck.com, author of the upcoming book, Prayer Prescriptions, Spiritual Remedies for Long-Lasting Health, and I am the host of the show. Kent Nurburn is my guest tonight, author of Ordinary Sacred. He is also the author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog and The Wolf at Twilight, as well as Simple Truths, Small Graces, and Letters to My Son. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Kent Nurburn. Hello, Kent. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing fine. Happy to be here.
Great. I'm so happy you're here. I was wondering, it looks to me as if you've spent a lot of time living amongst the Native Americans. And I know that all of the audience listening would love to know how this has informed your life and how this has been like for you.
I have indeed spent a lot of time living among the Native Americans. I think that it's informed my life and informed my way of writing in one simple fashion, and that is it's increased my sense of mindfulness. The Native people, whatever their particular tribes, have a belief in the immediate presence of spirit in every living thing. And by working among them, living among them, I've been able to take some of this into my own life. You know, we have this separation in our daily lives between the sacred and the profane. And the holy is something that we aspire to. But for the Native people, the holy, it becomes the sacred, and that inheres in everything. And so I believe that they also have an authentic spiritual vision that comes out of the land, out of this American soil, and speaks to our American heart. So I find it to have been a real leavening agent in my own growth, and I think it's a very fundamental spirituality that informs my work, and I think it informs Ordinary Sacred.
Yes, the one chapter in the book, The Ordinary Sacred, called The Circle, which was a ritual, I would say, of grief, and it was all surrounding a burial. And that is just an amazing story. The way you wrote it, too, it's kind of like, you know, bare bones, as it were.
Well, you know, it really was a story that, I mean, I won't say I wrote the book around that story, but I've been looking for a place to put that in a book because you write as well. I know that. And so you know how it is. Sometimes the wind catches you and lifts you and carries you in a way that you never expected. And you find writing, which sometimes is like pushing a stone up a hill, becomes almost a lyrical floating into a beautiful space. This story, I came back from the funeral. It's a story for the listeners, for you listeners, about attending a funeral on the Red Lake Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. And it's a reservation that's isolated and almost no white people live on it or go to it. And I taught up there for years. And one of my students had gotten killed in a car accident. And this is a story of going to his funeral and what the experience was like. And when I came back, I was so inhabited by the event that I just sat down and wrote the story. And it came out with a resonance that, I mean, I've always loved the story. And it speaks to the whole belief in the ceremonies of the ordinary, and that's what I really think that I'm trying to write about, and what I try to do in Ordinary Sacred is to bring the spirituality of any given moment to life, and this particular funeral was one of those moments.
Yes, it's a ceremony that, well, I would say grieving and studying the way people have their funerals of all throughout all the cultures is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, it's very, very, probably almost foreign to some people.
Well, it is. It's a foreign experience to those. But in fact, you know, one of the things that really struck me is my own father had died fairly soon or several years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been a passing that hadn't, I didn't think I was well served. I didn't think any of us were well served by the nature of the grief that we were able to experience. He was buried in a military cemetery, and, you know, I guess for those who have been in the military, there's some significance to those burials. But to me, it was just cars driving up. You've got a few minutes where they stand under a canopy. Then seven men you don't know fire off guns, and the casket is taken away. You don't see the burial take place. And
mm-hmm.
Then your father or loved one, the next time you see them, they're on a little stone hump in a sea of stone, white stone humps across hillsides. Whereas
mm-hmm.
the native burial is exactly the opposite. And oh, how I yearned for that when I thought about my father's death. After the ceremony in what was this, an old Quonset hut, actually, the casket was put in the back of a pickup truck, taken to a promontory that was on the land of the family land. And the young men who had been my students' friends had dug the hole with their hands. The casket is
mm-hmm.
placed in the hole, and we all then push the dirt in. Everyone is brought up. The elders said they're given a shovel and someone helps them, and they might just throw a little bit of dirt in. The children do the same. The young people get down on their hands and knees and push the dirt in, and we
mm-hmm.
all buried him. And it was then at the end, there is a simple prayer, and you're sent home. And it's as if you feel the passing, and you feel the chance to honor the dying and the giving back to the earth of the body. And so it was just a whole experience. And I never got over that. It felt so integrated, so right. And it was allowed grief to, it allowed us to pour our grief into each other and into the grave itself.
Yeah. It was almost like you all participated in what is called laying
mm-hmm.
the body to rest, and that it was a full participation of everybody there. Which,
you know, I talk about that. Yeah, I talk about the ceremony, and I should mention that because there was something very profound in that. That his friends, native drumming is really an attempt to recapitulate it's based on the human heartbeat, and
mm-hmm.
there were a group of young men around the drum, which is a big circular drum that's the size of a bass drum on its side with an animal skin over the top, and they beat it with mallets in a rhythm that approximates the heartbeat, and they sing that with songs that they've either heard in nature or that they've created themselves, and it's a sort of a ululation out of the throat. And while they were drumming, the woman who was in charge of the ceremony said, I want you all to come up, all of you who have experienced grief in your life. And all of us
mm-hmm.
have experienced grief, all of you who have lost something, whether it be a pet, a neighbor, a friend, a father, a mother, a child. And we all stood around the drum and put our arms around each other and were swaying back and forth. We didn't necessarily know each other, but we poured
mm-hmm.
our grief onto the drum. And she said to us, the drum is strong, the circle is strong, it can take your grief. And so we all were one in sharing
mm.
and pouring our own grief into this particular event. So when we left, I mean, we all know grief is a private thing, and it's so
mm-hmm.
different in every person. But when you come together to share it without articulating the nature of your own private grief or your own struggles, what the grief is, but just are there pouring your grief out together. It's a cathartic event, the likes of which I had really never experienced before.
Yes, it sounded like the drumming was reaching a crescendo, and how everybody was just getting into the deepness of the beat. And how would you describe the beat? Was it rhythmic? Was it fast? Was it slow?
Well, it's rhythmic, and one person will take the lead. It's a fairly fast rhythm. It's not as slow as a heartbeat, but mm-hmm. it's a fairly. There's no odd syncopations, or no one varies from the basic beat. It's sort of a bump, 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 and one person will rise up, hit harder than the others, will rise up with their beat to meet it, but it's all very rhythmic and hypnotic, and it becomes, it feels like blood pulsing, it feels like the heartbeat, it's a harmonic drumming. It's not something where there are individual riffs being done by someone you just common beat. So it takes you over. I mean, the drum for the native people is the symbol, because it's the circle. It's also the membrane of life, where what happens in one place affects everyone everywhere else, and that's how they feel about the drum. What strikes in one place reverberates in all parts of it. So you're standing around an ancient instrument that's also the metaphor for their understanding of life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm sure that what I'm imagining is a pulsation that actually is transmuted into your body as you're going about this amazing experience. Yeah.
Well, drumming is the same in almost every culture. It's the most elemental of the art forms, and any culture that uses the drum uses it to call people to awareness. And it's mm-hmm. because it's something that's so fundamental, there is nothing more basic than the sound of the human heart, and that's where the origin of drumming really comes from.
Right, the pulse, living pulse. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's just an amazing thing. So the ordinary sacred is something that it sounds to me. I haven't read your other books, but I'm very curious and actually want to get them. Especially, what I was going to say is, it seems like the ordinary sacred kind of weaves its way through as a theme through all of your books. But I haven't read them, so I don't know. So what do you say to that?
Well, absolutely. If there is a theme in all my books, it's a call to mindfulness in the moment. I've sort of used as the underlying notion in my own belief that we don't all live holy lives, but we live in a world alive with holy moments, and that mm-hmm. all of my deep interest is in how the spiritual manifests itself in our ordinary lives. And I wanted to write in this book, I wanted to write almost a, what would you say, not a guidebook, but I wanted to write a book that people could carry with them. I wanted it to be small. I wanted it to have stories of the absolute mm-hmm. ordinary. Can I read you a little piece from it?
Oh, my gosh, please. Yes,
all right.
That'd be great.
This will take about a minute, because it's the prologue, and this will tell the readers what the book really intends to do. And mm-hmm. the line that starts it is, "A divine voice sings through all creation." A traditional Jewish prayer. Years ago, I was traveling across the great Saskatchewan prairies, a young man alone with a love of the road and a dream in his heart. Evening was approaching, and long shadows were darkening the draws and stretching like fingers across the rolling golden land. A rancher passing in a truck saw me walking and stopped to pick me up. Like many who live in great spaces, he was a man of few words. We rode in peaceful silence until he noticed a break in the wire fence that ran along the side of the road. "Got to check my stock," he said. "Want to come along?" We walked to the top of a rise and looked out over the blowing amber grasslands. The sky above was fading to evening's lavender, and the wind hissed and sighed as it moved among the hills and draws, an endless sea of tall prairie grasses. The rancher turned to me and said a few words, but I could not make them out through the keening of the wind. I smiled and shrugged, and he went back to searching the distant hills for signs of his stock. When we got back to the truck, I apologized for not understanding what he had said. wasn't important, he said, just making conversation. It was the wind, I explained. It was so loud I couldn't hear you. He gave a short, knowing chuckle. Oh, yeah, the wind, he said. I don't even hear it anymore. The only time I notice it is when it stops. We rode on in silence until we came to a rutted gravel turnoff. This is my road, he said, and pulled over to let me out. I thanked him for the ride. We shook hands, and I stepped out into the tiny ribbon of highway that moves solitary off toward the west. How much it seems the voice of God in our lives like that wind, so constant, so present, that we only notice it when it stops. In times of crisis, the loss of a loved one, a marriage gone bad, a fight with a friend that leaves us feeling misunderstood and unloved, then we feel the great emptiness around us and reach out for the calming promise that we are not alone in the world. But God's voice has not stopped. Like that great Saskatchewan wind, it has only paused to catch its breath and to remind us by its silence to listen more closely and take it less for granted when it begins to whisper once again. This is a book for those who seek that whisper, who believe that God speaks as surely in the murmurs of the trees and the laughter of the children as from the pulpits of the churches and the synagogues, who know that a mother tucking a child into bed is offering a prayer of joyful praise as surely as the cantor or the minister or the monk at evening vespers. The great Hindu leader Mahatma Gandhi said it is better in prayer to have a heart without words than words without heart. Jesus in the Gospel of John said the wind blows where it will, and you hear its sound, but know not from whence it comes or where it is going. This book is a reminder to keep our hearts open to the winds of God's whispers. It is not important that we know from whence they come or to where they are going, or even if we give them a name. All we need to know is that the moments of love, of caring, of the unprecedented, unprotected human heart, whenever we encounter them, are the voice of the Spirit blowing like the wind through our everyday lives. Our task in life is to hear that voice and to make of each day a prayer that bears witness to its presence. And that's That's what I want this book to, wanted this book to be. The moments when we to make us stop and hear the presence of the wind. The simple moments when you when I overhear two women having a conversation at a table, where a young child mildly handicapped, retarded, is riding around me on a bicycle and I'm not paying proper attention to him. A dinner with friends, going to my father's toolbox to try to fix a light switch and finding that the toolbox reflects what he loved much more than the things that he thought that I might value after he passed. Just ordinary stories where we shine a light of significance on the ordinary events of the day. And we all have them. We all live with these moments that if we focus fine attention on them, if we bring them to mindfulness, the spiritual dimension of the day rises up inside of us. And it can calm us and get rid of some of the anger and the tension and the jangle and that comes from all the busyness and all the administrative affairs and the yelling at the other drivers and the hurrying to meet deadlines. It's just our lives have this holy silence at the center of them, this holy stillness, I should say, at the center of them. If we can be the artists of the ordinary and paint that moment in our memory so that we can go back to it. And this book is one that I hope people will just carry with them, like I said, in a purse, in a backpack. And when they feel, the stories are short. That's about as long as they are, that one that I just read, with the exception of the circle, which is fairly long. They're just almost homilies. They're meditations. And that was what I wanted to do in this book, because some of my other books go down different paths, but they all come back to that same thing, that we're all people struggling to be kind, to open our hearts to the mystery of life, and to be good to those around us and raise children who have and families whose lives are happy and healthy and wholesome and going forward. So that was really the goal with this book. And
well, you made that very well. I mean, it's simple, and it also, I think, inspires people to write their own stories that, just even a journal of the beautiful things that are all around them, miraculous, really.
Well, it is. Everything around us is miraculous, and And my contention is that we don't see this enough, and that I like I describe my own writing sometimes of being I feel like I'm a troll under a bridge holding up an angel on a stick. And I say to people, look at the angel, not at the troll under the bridge. And I have to look at the angel rather than the troll under the bridge, because so much spiritual writing is prescriptive, saying, you do this and your life will be better, do this and you will become a more spiritually insightful and holy person. And to me, those are kind of like diet books. That, you know, they're great if they work, but ultimately we all fall back. So why not instead embrace the ordinariness of the moment and find the sacred in the ordinary sacred, rather than seeking out something something so elevated that when the transient events of life come in upon us, we lose it all. And this is the Native American way of thinking. And they don't all live it either, but the idea that the sacred inheres in the ordinary at all points and all times, and it's up to us to see it and to find it and listen to its heartbeat.
Yeah. And so I can't help but mention that you have a doctorate in theology. Because as I'm hearing you speak, it really, you really, and the beginning of your book just speaks to religion to and spiritual. It sounds to me like you're really tying, and that you've learned to tie spirituality and religion together in a very beautiful, beautiful way.
Well, you know, if there's
not in a package, not in any way that you're restraining it, but it's but in some way that is really liberating it.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, because that's really what I want to do. If there, I said in one of my other small books, that the more meditative books, I think it was at the beginning of Small Graces, where I said that I cannot tell you how many times people come up to me and say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And I've got a brother-in-law who is who's a Franciscan priest, and he says when he hears that, he shakes his head and says, I don't understand that. And I said, well, you know, well, I do. You know, that if you happen to be someone who can find in a religious tradition something that fulfills you and allows you to be part of this, the great machinery of a spiritual tradition that has been honed and perfected over centuries and generations and has a spiritual genius at its center, then then you're a blessed person. But there are so many of us for whom the instinct and the impulse towards the spiritual is there, but we don't find a religious tradition into which we can fit comfortably anymore. And so those are the ones for whom I'm writing, the people who consider themselves spiritual but not religious. And and really, the doctorate in theology, I was actually trained in religious sculpture, and but had to do a fair amount of regular theology and comparative religion at the time. And it was moving gently over deep waters and trying to get powerful spiritual beliefs and theological concepts in presented in a simple way and manifested in daily living is really what I try to do in my books.
Yes, and I just love the idea of creating sculptures from oversized tree trunks. That's so cool.
Well,
and what were those sculptures about? What were they?
Well, what I try to do is inhabit was a sculpture of John the Baptist that I did for my doctorate. And I mentioned that just because it was about a year of working with that particular person. And I tried to find as best I could the capacity to inhabit his spirituality. And which is not easily done. I mean, this is a person from a different time, a different place, a man of the desert, a man of deep asceticism. And I had to try to find the spiritual touchstones of the man and then turn it into a form that reflected an image of a man that would keep, embodied that kind of a spiritual presence. And it's difficult because the nuances of sculpture are very, very great. You know, the turn of an eye, the twist of a hand, all of these carry meaning because we've built in the course of our own lives. If you notice when, like, say when you see any old person or even a person that's died, meaning remains in their hands. You will look at their hands and say, I understand that person, because the gestures and the actions that have taken place through an entire life have built into them something of deep significance and something irreducible. And to capture that in sculpture is to have to be very, very attuned to and attentive to the character and the spiritual dimension of the way everything reveals itself. Anyway, so what mm-hmm. I would try to do is to make a figure that would embody a spiritual state. I did one sculpture when I was living and when I was living out on a hillside in Northern California that was tried to embody the spirit of the land that I was in. And I wanted to. It had to have a dual dimension of the face had to have a dual dimension of sadness and resolution and peace and clarity. So they became meditations for me. I would if you spend you spend 6 months or a year with a chisel on and a piece of wood, what you find is that something that you learn that piece of wood and you become the character. They were long-term meditations for me. And like I wrote a book on the prayer of St. Francis because I needed to try to do something to clean myself out at one time. And that was 6 months of meditating on the prayer of make me an instrument of your peace. The sculptures, I might do a meditation on the sculpture might be a 6 month meditation on the spirit of John the Baptist, the spirit of like one time when I was having real struggles in my own life, I went to a monastery in British Columbia because they needed a sculpture of their patron saint, who was Joseph the Worker. And it was a wonderful thing to have to work in it because you think about Joseph and who is this man? This is a man who took on faith the fact that he was not that the child of the woman that he was with was divinely inspired. He raised him. He never speaks a word in the Gospels. He raised this child as his own. He gave up his entire life for a vision of his family and the spiritual importance of what he was doing. He embodied fatherhood as a quiet service that was it was amazing. So to do a sculpture of Joseph the Worker meant I had to become that, and I had to find something of my own best fatherhood in that, and it was a wonderful experience. So that was really that's how sculpture started to inform things. But I want to say one thing about it, because something happened in the process of working on these large trees, and this is what led me to Native American work in many ways, that these I would try to impose something like an image of Joseph the Worker on the tree. But after 6 months with a tree, it's like living in a room with someone else for 6 months. You get to know that person. Pretty soon that tree started talking back to me. And they would have their own life to them. I remember working on one oak tree that was so sad. And it was weeping. And I hated working on the tree in the sense that it was such a sad tree, and I could hardly bear the sadness of the tree. And pretty soon the spirit of the trees started to become as strong as the spirit of the forms that I was trying to impose on them. And I started looking around and saying, well, I'd been trained on Michelangelo, Donatello, and Rodin, who were sort of my three heroes, all of whom impose ideas and onto material. And here I was dealing with material that was talking back to me, and no one talked about that. So I looked around for who could tell me about that, and it was only the Native Americans who spoke of that. The Iroquois, for example, would carve their trees, carve their masks out of live trees because they wanted the spirit of the tree in the masks. And there are trees on in the Queen Charlotte Islands off the northwest coast where they will carve faces into the trees and then let the tree grow for centuries so that face grows with it. And this idea of the spirit of the material dominating over the spirit of the idea puts a humility into you. It says that the human being and the ideas of the human being do not dominate over nature. And that was how I found myself sneaking in through the back door, or actually should not sneaking in, being drawn in through the back door into the power of native spirituality. And so that's why
trees are so wonderful. They're grounding, it sounds like you're a tree hugger. I love it.
Well, it's more than a tree hugger. The tree
hugs you.
trees. When you think about a tree, trees are close to us in both physical scale and in time. We can't really, I mean, some people can understand a mountain. I can't understand a mountain. There are those people who can look at a small plant, and many people have that capacity to see that closely and with that sort of ephemeral vision. But a tree, it's understandable in our lifespan. It may live 300 years, but it's not eons. It's has a height like we understand. It's something that is, it has different life forces. It responds to the wind. It goes through seasons of the heart, and that it just, it's a wonderful meditation. And different trees have different characters if you stand there. And that, again, a native belief that the, for example, that they believe that the oak is one of the strongest trees because it stands alone on a hillside. And so they will value the oak as having a special character. They'll value each of the trees as having a special character. And they say they hold out their hands, like they hold out their boughs like we hold out our hands in worship to the sky. So the tree is really, I mean, it is a gift that if we spend time with a tree and get to know a tree, it's a wonderful, wonderful experience.
I'm curious about John the Baptist. What did you learn about John the Baptist through working on that tree trunk?
Well, it's so many years ago that I have to dig into the attic here. Let's see what I can find.
I'm just curious. I'm not a heavy-duty Christian by any means. I love the story, though, and just the thought of John the Baptist. I would love to know what you learned.
Well, he was burned pure. He was of a sect that was an apocalyptic sect that lived in the desert. It lived in caves, essentially, the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he was a total ascetic. Thought maybe he would fast, he would live on insects and bugs. He was someone who had been burned pure by both the power of the Spirit and the power of the land. So I saw him as someone who was almost a hollow form, that he allowed the forces of nature, the forces of the desert, the forces of Jewish apocalyptic spirituality to blow through him. He was a vessel. He was like a reed. He was like a flute, a dark flute playing, playing the music of the precursor, bringing the bringing the word of Jesus to the the word of the coming of someone greater than him to the people. And at the same time, he was. Whereas Jesus was ostensibly the giver of redemption and a chance to renew your life, John was a bringer of the withering forces of purification. So I really saw him. In fact, I did him as a I think I did him bald isn't the right word, but that was what it was, because I wanted someone who had no. Who was paired to the absolute bone, whose muscles were had been honed to the point where they were all that was left. Most of the flesh, most of the richness of human experience had been pared out of him, both by necessity and by his cultural experience. So it was a very, very ascetic figure and a very, very ascetic study. And I don't know that it was ultimately a very healthy thing to spend time with. It was probably good for me, but it was hard. It was a very hard piece to do.
Yes. Well, it's amazing to think of asceticism or somebody who is that removed from our culture in any way, in every way, and just living totally next to the earth, it sounds like.
Well, and most of the asceticism that we know in our own lives is more benign, like the Buddhist ascetics are. There's a self abnegation, but it's not for the sake of it's for the sake of transcending and removing the self, the husk of the self, to get to something purer and what more benign, I guess, is the word that comes to mind. You know, the compassionate indifference. That it's a very gentle yin sort of spirituality and spiritual asceticism, whereas John the Baptist was It was an ordeal by fire. This was the
probably the
fire of the tongue, you know, the fire from the tongues of God, or the tongues of fire from God that purified him. So it's a very different kind of spirituality. And that's, to me, that's the fun. It was the fun of sculpture, and it's the significance of the kind of writing that I try to do, that we all have a different spiritual temperament, a different spiritual capability. And what we're born to may or may not be the one that fits mm-hmm. us the way that we want, that is most comfortable. I mean, we're born where we're born. We were raised with the language we're raised with. We're raised in the tradition we're raised with. But it may mm-hmm. not be the most spiritually compatible lifestyle and vision and spirituality. I like to say that, you know, God is like, and this again comes a bit from the Native American thing, that God is like a great symphony. Mm-hmm. They talk about God being sometimes the light behind the sky, and that the spirit, the souls are the stars are the souls that have gone up through the, you know, through the darkness of the firmament, and that's the light of God. The totality of God is the light shining behind. But if you look at it as if we're like the spiritual instruments in God's symphony, each of us has the capability of playing a different kind of music. And it's up mm-hmm. to us to try to find the music that we can play on our own spiritual instrument. And perhaps we're part of some section of the spiritual orchestra, perhaps the Buddhist, the Hindu section, whatever works for us. Or perhaps we play a solo instrument, but we have to all play our part in the great voice and symphony of God. And I mm-hmm. want my works to ratify that in people. I mean, there is no tradition that I don't bow before, saying mm-hmm. that this is someone greater than I. If it's become significant over the, you know, over a period of time, there's a reason why it became significant. And greater minds, greater thoughts, greater spirits than mine have brought it into the fore. When it takes mm-hmm. a bad turn, and when it, any tradition that where you find people harming children or the weak, at that point, to me, it's taken a bad turn. But mm-hmm. all religions have a magic and a beauty in them, and all spiritual traditions. And I think it's incumbent upon us all to honor all the traditions that other people have, and certainly not to judge them, and to do the best we can to try to find one that fits for us.
That's right. Well, through all of this, when did you decide that you were a writer?
I've always been a writer. I never really wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a sculptor. Sculpture was sort of the way that I was going to save my soul. It was what I loved sculpture. But writing, I sort of fell into it. I'd always written my whole life. I'd gotten paid for writing. I'd written all through graduate school. I'd written for campus papers and been a writer, in fact, for the Governor's Crime Commission in Minneapolis years and years ago. But always writing almost as a meditative act and as a spiritual. You talked about journaling. I'd done it almost as a way of giving voice to the poetry of my own spirit. And so, when the piece I read, you hear a strong musicality in my writing. I try mm-hmm. not to inhabit it with ideas above and beyond the music of things. To me, when I'm going to prepare to write, I don't go read other writers. I listen to music, and I have to be very careful, because music will shape the speed of my writing, it will shape the melody of my writing, it will shape the arc and the lyricism. So between prayers and spiritual writing of the great traditions and music is sort of where I find my source point as a writer. And when mm-hmm. I'm on my game, it really is almost like musical composition more than it is like the exposition of thought. So it was something I just sort of stumbled into, and my friends at New World Library actually were the ones that allowed me to pursue my writing. I'd been I was working primarily in sculpture, and then when I was on the reservation, I took a job on the reservation to do oral history with the young people on the Red Lake Reservation here in northern Minnesota. And when I got done there, I didn't know whether I wanted to go back to sculpture or not. It wasn't economically viable, and I think that I've said that I had, you know, there's a curse. If I wanted to curse someone in the arts, which is not a good thing to want to do to anybody, but I would say, may you be great, but not good. And that's what I was. I had moments of greatness as a sculptor, but I was not, I wasn't a natural. Whereas when it came to writing, I was a much more natural writer, and my friends at New World Library, actually the publisher was an old friend of mine from years and years ago. We grew up together, and he asked if there's something I'd like to do on writing. I said, well, you know, I was 40 at the time, and I said, you know, I've got this young son. He was just born, and I just, and I had the freshness of young love, of confidence. I had all the theological background that I had. I had this wonderful son that was the light of my life, and I said, you know, I'd like to write a book for him that would tell him what it is that I think he needs to know if I were to die before he reaches adulthood. So I wrote letters to my son, and that was just sort of how it started. And I wrote it again. It was a very musical book. It's very confidence. It's got a drum beat to it that my other works don't have. And I read it now, and I say, boy, I could never write that again. I'm glad I wrote it when I did, because it has a confidence of it has a conviction about it that now, now I'm much more compromised in my understanding of the world, and there's this and there's that and there's the maybes and the what ifs, and I could have done better and I should have done better. But at that time, it was like I was just alive with the love of life and the magic of what was going on around me. So from that, it just proceeded, and then they let me follow my heart and what I write about. And so I'll dig deep into Native American issues, like Neither Wolf Nor Dog and The Wolf of Twilight are two books about travels with an Indian elder, and sort of explores the experience of the Native people in America. And then I'll come up for air like An Ordinary Sacred and say, okay, now I want to resolve this and put something out that has a purity and clarity so people will be able to take it in slowly and just eat it like a delicious dessert or a piece of precious fruit, and then maybe I'll dive back into something that will take me deeper again. But that's been sort of the rhythm back and forth, and I've never really looked back. I've just always stayed with writing ever since then.
Right. The Neither Wolf Nor Dog and The Wolf at Twilight. What are those books about?
They're both about travels with an Indian man, a Lakota elder, and they were done in response to my time on the reservation. I loved working on the reservation. I loved the people. It was not at all what I had expected. I learned so much from them about embracing a larger sense of family, about, like as I mentioned before, about the spiritual inhering in all dimensions of even the most ordinary in life, about the valuing of the elders, how the young people are sent to the elders for guidance, how the young people are given special responsibilities. They're not just waiting to become adults like they are in our dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And many of these values have sort of been lost in Native culture, but in many cases they never existed in ours. And I got done with my time on the reservation and said, I want to give something back to these people. And through a various series of events, I was able to begin writing the story of the travels with this Lakota elder out on the reservations in South Dakota. And I was able to put their beliefs and his belief about what was important for us to know. He talks about the difference between the freedom and honor, how we're a people of freedom, whereas they were a people of honor. The difference between leaders and rulers, about how they sought leaders, whereas we give power to rulers. And they'd say, well, how can someone have power over you because you've elected them for a period of time? That in our tradition, if we no longer support that person, we walk away from them. Because they no longer call us to them, so they're no longer our leaders. He talked about more sociological things, like about how the Native Americans have sort of become the jewelry on American culture that people want to claim Native American heritage. the only minority group that people are, that white people try to get into appears to be Indians. Everyone says, oh, I've got a little Cherokee in me. I've got a little, you know, I've got an Indian
yeah.
back somewhere.
Right.
But they never say, oh, I've, you know, I've got a, you know, I've got an African American in the background. If they're white, they just don't. There's something in the native that fascinates us. And he talked about that. And he always, you know, would always make a joke. It's always the Cherokee grandmother. He said, you know, it's not the, mm-hmm. it's not a Potawatomi grandfather. It's a Cherokee grandmother. And so, it was just him telling the stories about what his people believed, how the world looked to him, to us. And
yeah.
how our world looked to him. And that was in Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And in The Wolf of Twilight, I decided I had to go a little deeper into one of the darker sides of Native experience, and that's the Indian boarding schools, which mm. were one of the real tragic unknown stories in American experience. And too many people were reading Neither Wolf Nor Dog and taking it in too much as celebratory about this is
yeah.
oh, Indians are so wonderful, and I wanted to dig a little bit into the darkness and have it come out in the light, but I had to go into the darkness, and the Native boarding schools were just a horrifying experience where children were taken from their families, told that their grandparents were spoke the words of the devil, had their hair shorn when Indians never cut their hair except in times of grief, just bad things were done to them. And so I needed to tell some of that story. And so I tell the story of Dan, the elder's search for his little sister who had been taken away and lost in the boarding schools when they were young. And he now at the end of his life was seeking to find out what had happened to her. So it's a very poignant tale, almost a mystery, but they're both real revelations of the native experience in
mm-hmm.
in America. And have become, you know, I consider that one of my real accomplishments in life is that those books have become pivotal in taught in curriculum, in curricula all across America, and they're used in Europe and in Australia and New Zealand, about
mm-hmm.
Native people and what has happened to the Native people. And leading us, I'm able to do it because I can lead the non-Native reader. I can take them by the hand, and they don't have to feel that they're going somewhere where they have no one with them. I become the guide to take them into that
mm-hmm.
culture. And so they've become very significant books in that regard, and I'm very, very honored to have written them. And I'm currently working on a third book in the trilogy, and this one is proving to be the pushing the stone up the mountain, but it'll come
mm-hmm.
out. I'll get it to the top, and it'll roll down the other side. So.
Yes, you don't have a title for that one yet.
No, we sort of vary between The Child of the Buffalo Moon, The Song of the Buffalo Child, somewhere in that direction. But
mm-hmm.
it depends a lot on what works right, what has the right rhythm, what the people at the company tend to think is the right title. You know, so we struggle
right.
with it, but it's not there. It'll tell me its name when it wants to tell me its name, is the way I look at it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, how many children, American Indian children, Native American children, have been lost in the boarding school system? This is kind of a shock.
Well, the boarding school system, how many were lost in the system is hard to say. How many were affected by the system is an entire generation. It was started... It was started at the turn of the century as a way to inculcate Christian values into the Native people. And
right.
They were taken, they said, you got to kill the Indian to save the man. And so they took these little kids from their families. They would kidnap them.
Kidnap them, right.
Literally kidnap them, send them to these boarding schools, where the first thing that was done was they were shorn of their hair, their clothing was burned, they were washed in kerosene, they were told they couldn't speak their language and they could only speak English. And there are so many stories about little kids who would stand there. They were given these clothes to wear that in the boys' cases they were usually made from old army uniforms, and they would stand there. They wouldn't even know how to ask to go to the bathroom, and then they just stand there until they urinated in their pants, and then they had to wear them for the entire week.
Mm-hmm.
But the deeper issue is things like being told that what your parents believed was wrong and was going to send them to a place where they were going to burn forever in a fire. They used to do things like put a cigarette on the back of a child's hand and say, "You feel that pain. That pain is what your parents are going to feel forever because of the way that they believe. And you can't listen to them when you go back to them." They were ripped apart from their own traditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it became sort of cultural. People look at the native world now and they say, geez, you know, all the junk cars, all the trash, and you know, all the dysfunction. Well, it's cultural post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, my gosh, that's interesting, yeah.
And I'll tell you, you know, one of the, here's the kind of real horrible story that I didn't even put in the book, but this one always, I didn't put it in the book, but I feel always compelled to tell it because it's so horrifying. You've got these dormitories with all these kids, and then the girls and boys are separate. And these little girls in this one school were in the dormitory at night, and the girls would get pregnant. Sometimes it was from the staff, sometimes it was from the priests, maybe it was from the other kids, but
yeah,
it was most likely from the adults because the boys and girls were kept separate.
Mm-hmm.
And they hid the pregnancies. And then in this one case, this woman told about how there was one girl that she tried to hide her pregnancy, but they took her away one day. And down the hall, they heard the crying of a baby, and they saw a woman, one of the matrons, running by in the hall. They were all peering out the door. They saw her running by in a hall, down the hall, holding a bundle and a blanket. Then they heard the stove open and heard the door shut, and they said, We knew the smell of burning flesh. And, I mean, this is the kind of thing that is so dark. And I didn't want to go there in the book because people hear things like that and they say, I don't want to read anymore. I don't want to hear about this stuff.
I'll tell you now, I'm a nurse and, I'm a labor and delivery nurse, as a matter of fact, and have been in women's health for many years. And that is just appalling. But
yeah, I mean,
surprised, you know, I'm not surprised.
I needed to bring some of that story out, but I wanted to come out at the end with a vision of, and Dan does, he speaks of how he sees the vision of us coming together at the end of Wolf of Twilight, but those, I mean, if you're a nurse, you understand then about the trauma that someone goes through when they lose a child, and to have an entire generation lose its parent. Yeah, and how do you carry that kind of anger in you? No wonder people commit suicide. No wonder they become alcoholics.
And no wonder they hate the American government.
Right, hate the American government and hate the Dan at one point says if any Indian looked too closely at what had happened, they couldn't bear the anger. And so to me, it's letting in writing those books, it was letting some of the pressure out. And yet when you come to something and then you see something as beautiful as the funeral that I write about in Ordinary Sacred,
right.
And you see what you see is beneath the wound and the injury is our cultural traditions and beliefs that are absolutely important for all of us to learn. And I think that's the case with any tradition. I mean, if we just look at contemporary Christianity and see how strange the manifestations are of the fundamentalists, and that's not the way of Jesus. That's not the way of the best visions of the Saint Francis's of the world. So we just have to say that we have to look beneath the manifestations that have gone wrong and say, where is the purity? Where is the heart in religious tradition that we need to embrace and learn from each of them? So that's kind of been my struggle.
I was going to say, that the fact that what you write about in Ordinary Sacred, about just a good example would be the chapter called The Circle and the grieving, it seems to me as if what happened with the boarding school mysteries, you know, the children disappearing and the squelching of trying to squelch a culture, actually was not successful.
No.
Because they kept their culture alive and have done that. And that is a beautiful, to say that kind of thing didn't work, what happened at the turn of the century. And probably, how many years did that stuff to go on probably for many years.
Well, there are still boarding schools in existence today, although they're certainly much more benign. But there were, up through the middle 20th century in the 50s, there were still very, very bad practices, and you know, there are many lawsuits about child abuse because of that time and up through the 50s. But
right.
You know, one of the things that the Native people say to me is that you have to understand that you have, as a culture, tried to eradicate us for 500 years, and you haven't
mm-hmm.
succeeded. And the reason you haven't succeeded is because we know how to forgive. And
yeah.
that's kept us from being eaten alive. We know how to forgive and try to go on. And
right.
And the one thing that they all say to me, no matter what, when you ask what is the one thing you wish, they, whether it be an educated person, a person with no education, whatever tribe, they say, we just wish your government would say, we're sorry. Because no one has said we're sorry to us. In Canada, they're saying we're sorry. How heartfelt is anybody's guess. In Australia, there are reconciliation commissions. But we never say we're sorry to people for having essentially occupied them and tried to eradicate them.
Mm-hmm.
And they will tell you, and the best of them will say, you know, our time is coming. We are the voice of this land. We are the spirit of this land, and we are the heartbeat of this land, and you will
mm-hmm.
begin to hear us again. So that's I try to keep that alive because I think their time is coming. They understand
so,
something.
So that's
about
a beautiful that. End to what we were just discussing, because it's kind of horrific to think of what you called cultural post-traumatic stress syndrome,
mm-hmm.
and then to realize that that is just part of the story, that the whole story is not finished, but we are going to see a renaissance of that culture. Or it's already happening. We just, our dominant culture is about to, I think in some ways, fall, and that's a real relief.
Well, hopefully it's a husk that falls off, and that fascination with the Native experience that seems to never go away inside of our American character will blossom forth into something. And
yes.
that really is what The Wolf of Twilight is about. And so I encourage anyone who hears this and thinks that that's of some interest to pursue to pick up The Wolf of Twilight. I think they'll find it to be instructive in that regard and be done.
Yes,
as,
I'm gonna
and
get
it's a
that.
Story. Yeah. It's just a good story to read.
That. Well, I appreciate your coming on the show so much, Kent, and I think we could talk much longer than this, but we're restricted by 60 minutes. When you come out with the third book in the trilogy, though, I would love to have you back, and we can continue this discussion.
Well, I would be happy to come back, and I encourage anyone who's interested in you know, I've sort of been covering the waterfront here, but anyone who's interested can go to my website at kentnerburn.com. That's kentnerburn.com. And you can look up some of the other books, look up some of these ideas, and see if it makes sense to you. And if it's worth pursuing, go further. And
I hope that Ordinary
Sacred will touch people.
Oh, it does. And I think everybody over at New World Library just loves it, of course, and I loved it. And they can go to New World Library, too. And it sounds like all of your books are published in New World Library. Am I correct?
There's a few that were published by Harper San Francisco, but the majority of them
okay.
are in New World Library. And that's where the St. Francis book was by Harper, and there was a long book on Chief Joseph, a big historical narrative. But Letters to My Son, Small Graces, Simple Truths, Wolf of Twilight, Another Wolf and a Dog, all of these are New World Library books. They've been a good publisher for me, and we've worked well together.
Of course. They're wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Kent, and I wish you well. Happy writing.
Well, I hope that this rock and pushing up the hill takes wings and transmutes into a butterfly, and so it'll fly off and become a good book. So, well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the time.
It's been great to meet you.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.